welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And on top of all of this, we need to continue as we, because we're giving you content, folks, so you can learn. So as we learn, we can start more properly understanding what we need to do, and therefore learn, pray, and act so that we can be more efficacious in our efforts. So with that, the whole point is demanding full compliance of the Constitution. We want you to start understanding that until you start helping people connect the dots, that their problems, it's not because of this person. It's not because of Obama. Obama only used the leverage that was given to him from Johnson, FDR, from all of the progressives prior. And he just built upon it. It's not like he was the guy that did the damage. The damage started with Hamilton and Marshall. Whether it was Noble, back in those days, oh, those guys were good. No, they were doing things that they shouldn't have done. And that means it was wrong. That means it needs to be corrected. That means we have to do that. Therefore, we have to start demanding full compliance to the Constitution. I think it's that simple. Now, we got Tammy with us. Welcome back, Tammy. And we were covering June 14th. We just went through George Mason's dismantling of the militia and how this was going to be done because they were going to single-handedly choose to do that. And he didn't happen to point out that, oh, well, this whole process of what they're going to do will be unconstitutional. It's not because the Constitution gives them the power. Actually, the Constitution demands very specific things that they have to do. And they're going to choose to do things that they don't want to do. And if that's the case, then, they're going to do these things unconstitutionally. But he doesn't want to frame it that way because his effort is focused on trying to get the Constitution not ratified. He wants them to reject the Constitution. And to me, that's the devil's advocate kind of thing. Anyway, so with that, let's go ahead and dive into Madison's response to Mason regarding standing armies. So we're on Madison 24 standing armies. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I most cordially agree with the honorable member last up that a standing army is one of the greatest mischiefs that can possibly happen. It is a great recommendation for this system that it provides against this evil more than any other system known to us, and particularly more than the old system of confederation. The most effectual way to guard against a standing army is to render it unnecessary. The most effectual way to render it unnecessary is to give the general government full power to call forth the militia and exert the whole natural strength of the Union when necessary.
Okay, so hold on here.
Thus you will furnish...
Okay. So hold on. The most effectual way to render it unnecessary is to give the general government full power to call forth the militia. Do they have full power to call forth the militia in the Constitution?
Yes.
They don't have full power to ignore that. That is the only way they can basically create an army. They can't go and create a mercenary army. That would be unconstitutional. See my point? That's exactly what he's saying here. Go ahead.
Thus you will furnish the people with sure and certain protection without recurring to this evil, and the certainty of this protection from the whole will be a strong inducement to individual exertion. Does the organization of the government warrant a belief that this power will be abused? Can we believe that a government of federal nature, consisting of many colloquial sovereignties, and particularly having one branch chosen from the people, would drag the militia unnecessarily to an immense distance? This, sir, would be unworthy of the most arbitrary despot. They have no temptation whatever to abuse this power. Such abuse could only answer the purpose of exciting the universal indignation of the people and drawing on themselves the general hatred and detestation of their country.
Okay, keep going.
I cannot help thinking that the honorable gentleman has not considered in all its consequences the amendment he has proposed. Would this be an equal protection, sir, or would it not be a most partial provision? Some states have three or four states in contact. Were this state invaded as it is bounded by several states, the militia of three or four states would, by this proposition, be obliged to come to our aid, and those from some of the states would come a far greater distance than those of others. There are other states which, if invaded, could be assisted by the militia of one state only, there being several states which border but on one state. Georgia and New Hampshire would be infinitely less safe than the other states. Were we to adopt this amendment, we should set up those states as butts for invasion, invite foreign enemies to attack them, and expose them to peculiar hardships and dangers. Were the militia confined to any limited distance from their respective place of abode, it would produce equal, nay, more inconveniences. The principles of equality and reciprocal aid would be destroyed in either case.
Okay, so one of the things he points out here is that when we when we are attacked, if they created this amendment, it would tie the federal government's hands strategically that they couldn't deploy any militia force beyond a certain point. They should be able to deploy whatever the national exigencies require. If France, Britain, and Spain all desire to attack from Georgia or attack from Canada, you know, from Florida or Canada, since it's outside, in that respect, then all of the forces of the Union would be basically marshaled to that area. If it was a two-pronged attack from the south and the north, then they would have to divide the forces to basically repel those invaders. I mean, why would... I said this yesterday, that Mason was looking to really create his signature to the Constitution. Now, I very rarely put it in this perspective, but it's like a dog marking its territory. When Mark Levin pushed and published his, and I know I'm going to upset people, his Liberty Amendments, which would actually be more harmful than good, then Mark Levin is only looking to urinate on the Constitution with his mark. That's all they're doing. I mean, if the Constitution really requires it, it becomes everybody would agree. But it's those sycophants that may want to see, you know, the ability and the empowerment of the convention to actually start stepping in and start whittling in. And this is the way you can attack the Constitution. The enemy knows this. This is why the efforts of the Constitutional Convention has been on full force since the 80s. Because that's when the conversation started, because I remember getting engaged in that. And it came down to this. The Constitution is not the problem. We have to enforce it. That was basically the epiphany that I had with my father in the early 90s. Yeah, you know, we looked at it, and then we started to talk about amendments, and then we realized that the Constitution is not the problem. We just have to start enforcing it. So, okay, with that, go ahead and keep going.
Okay. I cannot conceive that this Constitution, by giving the general government the power of arming the militia, takes it away from the state governments. The power is concurrent, not exclusive. Have we not found from experience that while the power of arming and governing the militia has been solely vested in the state legislatures, they were neglected and rendered unfit for immediate service? Every state neglected too much this most essential object, but the general government can do it more effectually. Have we not also found that the militia of one state were almost always insufficient to secure its harassed neighbor? Did all the states furnish their quotas of militia with sufficient promptitude? The assistance of one state will be of little avail to repel invasion, but the general head, the general head of the whole union can do it with effect, if it be vested with power to use the aggregate strength of the union. If the regulation of the militia were to be committed to the executive authority alone, there might be reason for providing restrictions. But, sir, it is the legislative authority that has this power. They must make a law for the purpose.
And this is where I go down the path of they really failed in creating a strong national militia system. Washington wanted an army. He didn't have an army. So that's one of the reasons why he balked instead of deploying the militia. I think on the other instance, I don't think that he wanted to necessarily create this powerful army, but he preferred to have an army. But he supported the Constitution. He also was very weary of trying to bring whip deadly force out onto the people of America, which is why he basically stalled for a few years before he said, okay, we have to do this. And we're going to get into this where Madison says riotous behavior, protests are not acceptable. If you are not happy with what's going on in government, you have the right to petition them, and that was baked into their system at the state level. But it was more important, I think that's why Madison added that to the Bill of Rights, the right of assembling and petitioning government for the redress of government, for the redress of grievances. So as I analyze how they move forward, they really failed in creating and demanding, because when they started creating new states, it was more important to get the states into the union than to make the states capable of sustaining themselves, just as they're talking today, to really be able to defend themselves against their own internal problems. I mean, it's one thing if you're being invaded, but if you have your own insurrection, you know, it's going to be at a campus, because back in those days, and I don't know if you knew this, but John Adams, actually, I think it was one of his children, had a child in Harvard. There was a drunken, riotous, revolt or, rioting going on at Harvard. And John Adams' grandson was basically kicked out of school, and it brought shame upon the family. They did not allow the acting out, this emotional behavior from kids. They didn't allow it back then. Why do we allow it today? Because the judges say, oh, well, that's your right of protest. No, it's not. It's uncivil behavior. And if we have a civil society, we have to look at that as unacceptable, period. It's just like when you look at your child, when you have a child that wants to act up and be uncivil, then you're enabling that child. Law and order, and basically order, period, within the home is necessary. In society, it is necessary. So,
like we do in our home, they have to disagree appropriately.
That's right. Okay, so keep going.
The honorable member is under another mistake. He wishes martial law to be exercised only in time of war and under an idea that Congress can establish it in time of peace. The states are to have the authority of training the militia according to the congressional discipline and of governing them at all times when not in the service of the Union. Congress is to govern such part of them as may be employed in the actual service of the United States, and such part only can be subject to martial law. The gentlemen in opposition have drawn a most tremendous picture of the Constitution in this respect. Without considering that the power was absolutely indispensable, they have alarmed us with the possible abuse of it, but have shown no inducement or motive to tempt them to such abuse.
Okay, so before you go too much farther, that first green part was definitive. He laid it out there. Congress is to govern such part of them as may be employed. They can't govern while they're not in their service. So they can only govern them. They can set the standards, and they tell the states, how to discipline them while they're under the state's control. When they bring them in, then that's when they have the authority, because They literally, they don't have to declare war to go into an insurgency, to stop an insurgency. They don't have to declare war to execute the laws of the Union. The only thing that they would declare war technically would be an invasion. But if they have a need to execute the laws of the Union, like the Whiskey Rebellion, then they have the power to do that. In other words, they don't need to declare war. But if they do, and this is what Madison says, and when they actually are in the actual service of the United States, and such part only can be subject to martial law. In other words, that is the group, that is the part that can be subject to martial law. Not the whole United States, not the militias throughout the states themselves. Only the militia they've pulled forward and have deployed in those circumstances. Does that make sense? So people make the accusation that Lincoln put the United States under martial law, the entire United States. He didn't have the authority to do that. It says right here, Congress is to govern such of them. And so they're the ones that will dictate whether it is martial law or not. The president has no authority to do that. And they can only declare martial law where the militia has been deployed for the issue, like an insurgency, or because it's not about it's not about law enforcement, not just about executing the laws. It is whether they're using excessive deadly force in suppressing a militia, or not suppressing a militia, suppressing an insurrection, and or if they're being excessively, killing and so forth, just being very reckless in stopping an invasion where civilians and property damage and those types of things. The whole point of martial law is to make sure that you can hold accountable those people that you've given this carte blanche ability to go and destroy things and kill people. And so the whole point of that is to be able to have tribunals to basically review and hold that person accountable. All right, so keep going. Thank you.
Would the legislature of the state drag the militia of the eastern shore to the western frontiers, or those of the western frontiers to the eastern shore, if the local militia were sufficient to effect the intended purpose? There is something so preposterous and so full of mischief in the idea of dragging the militia unnecessarily from one end of the continent to the others that I think there can be no ground of apprehension. If you limit their power over the militia, you give them a pretext for substituting a standing army. If you put in the power of the state governments to refuse the militia by requiring their consent, you destroy the general government and sacrifice particular states. The same principles and motives which produce disobedience to requisitions will produce refusal in this case.
And I wish Madison would have actually injected in the pretext for substituting a standing army. I wish he would have injected that, if they actually decide to do that, they would be in violation of the Constitution. They have to use the militia. The only way they cannot use the militia is for the states to give them an amendment. And I'm here to tell you, if the states want that kind of an amendment, they would be foolish. They would want to do everything they could to make sure that the federal government had the militia forces to do their job. It doesn't make sense, other than the fact that sometimes they colluded, like with the 17th Amendment. The progressives got states not to seat senators in the Senate. They did this so that they could force an amendment that would basically force the selection, because what was happening was the certain state legislatures were not selecting a senator, and that state did not have any representation. Why would they do that? Because they were progressive, and they wanted to create a hole in the Constitution by changing. This is why the 17th Amendment didn't do what everybody thought it did. It created the paradigm that it did, and they got away with it. Because it changed who was responsible for choosing the senator. And in this particular case, in the 17th Amendment, they're chosen by the people instead of the state legislature. So that way, the Senate would actually be occupied because the people would do their job. That's all they were basically changing. They didn't change the responsibility of giving the state legislature suffrage. That's why this five-page article, The Truth About the 17th Amendment, is out there so that people can kind of see this. But bottom line, they used an amendment and the ambiguity of the amendment to think, well, everybody's going down this path of, you know, I'll just say, when you look at the fact that who elects them, everybody thinks that those are the people that have the control, or they're answering to the people. The Constitution clearly dictates who is supposed to be, you know, represented by the Senate. The Senate is to represent the state legislature, not the people. That's the demand in the Constitution. Oh, but the people are appointing them. Who cares? The Constitution still demands that their equal suffrage cannot be taken away. Read the article, and then you go, oh, wow, we've been duped. We actually surrendered. The states have actually surrendered their suffrage in the Senate because everybody believes that they're not accountable anymore. And that didn't occur in the amendment. Only the appointing and replacing. That's it. The responsibility is still to give them their suffrage. Anyway, hopefully that makes sense. But with that, I'm out of the rat hole. Go ahead.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The restrictions, which the honorable gentleman mentioned to be in the British Constitution, are all provisions against the power of the executive magistrate. But the House of Commons may, if they be so disposed, sacrifice the interests of their constituents in all those cases. They may prolong the duration of mutiny bills and grant supplies to the king to carry on an impolitic war. But they have no motives to do so, for they have strong motives to do their duty. We have more ample security than the people of Great Britain. The powers of the government are more limited and guarded, and our representatives are more responsible than the members of the British House of Commons.
I'm sorry, keep going. Yeah, keep going.
Okay.
So Mr. Clay, because this, Clay. Yeah, they're going back and forth here. Go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Clay apprehended that by this power our militia might be sent to the Mississippi. He observed that the sheriff might raise the posse comitatus to execute the laws. He feared it would lead to the establishment of a military government, as the militia were to be called forth to put the laws into execution. He asked why this mode was preferred to the old established custom of executing the laws. And then Mr. Madison answered that the power existed in all countries that the militia might be called forth for that purpose under the laws of this state and every other state in the Union, that public force must be used when resistance to the laws required it, otherwise society itself must be destroyed, that the mode referred to by the gentleman might not be sufficient on every occasion, as the sheriff must be necessarily restricted to the posse of his own county. If the posse of one county
just to clarify that one little point, he can't form a posse. His jurisdiction's limited to the county, just like the state militia is limited to the state, you know, the boundaries of the state.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Right. Okay. If the posse of one county were insufficient to overcome the resistance to the execution of the laws, this power must be resorted to. He did not by any means admit that the old mode was superseded by the introduction of the new one, and it was obvious to him that when the civil power was insufficient, this mode would never be put in practice.
All right, sorry about that, folks, but we kind of had to play with some volume, and we will be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so usually I do not include the Mr. Firebrand himself, Patrick Henry, but in this particular case, he brings up some information, or he brings up the paradigm of the time, and I think it's worth capturing, because in this nation, it was forged with the paradigm that every man be armed. That every man had a responsibility, whether you were, you know, had no spine, feckless, whatever you want to call it. It didn't matter. You needed to be able to carry a firearm. Now, let me say this. Firearms are the most powerful equalizer in the world. It doesn't matter whether you have the strength to knock your opponent out. If he's got a gun and you have a gun, you have equal power as him. Now, if your gun's bigger, your bullets are bigger, you're kicking better punch, you know, more fatal, what have you. So that's why I constantly say that in today's era, muskets are no longer equal. This is why every person's to be armed, not the military. That the type of armaments that the U.S. military has should not be in your local police's hands. It should be in the people's hands to defend themselves from tyranny of government. That never happens, and people, as long as people are in check, but when people are sleeping and evil people take over, next thing you know, things start moving and they corrupt it. They start stealing elections, and it's almost like there's no stopping it. It's like they're running recklessly, you know, to the cliff to push us all off. Oh, they wouldn't do that, but that's exactly what they're doing. So anyway, I think it was imperative to kind of cover what he states right here. I typically, you know, he usually uses, you know, hyperbole to a point where I go, okay. Just like Mason, but Mason, you could tell Mason actually had a personal interest in what was going on. I think Patrick Henry, he didn't. He wasn't trying to, you know, put his name onto a Bill of Rights or use my Bill of Rights that we created in Virginia. Let me do one aside. Because I don't think people understand the magnitude here. When people ask, or when I ask people, and I'll ask you, who came up with the statement and when every person is created equal, or all persons created equal, that line, right? We know where that line came from, right? Mm-hmm. What line, where did that come from?
The Declaration of Independence.
And who wrote that? Thomas Jefferson. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, but did Thomas Jefferson write that in 1776? No. Just like Mason actually, you know, came up with these pithy, you know, statements and so forth. Most people, if you go read the Bill of Rights that he created for Virginia, he echoed Thomas Jefferson's all men were created equal, but that was stated by Thomas Jefferson in 1770 in a legal case where he was defending the rights of a mulatto to be freed. In Virginia, a person of mixed race, black and white, they would have to fulfill their obligation to slavery till the 31st year. And then after that point in life, they are to be freed so that they can enjoy freedom, because that innuendo or that concept, well, they're half slave, half free, well, then give them half their life as free. So that's how they made that law, right? Okay, so in that perspective, Thomas Jefferson actually stated all men were created equal. And that's when he created that argument to try to even say, and I think this is one of the reasons why they ruled against him. He lost that case because it would have opened the door to, you know, freeing slaves, if that makes sense. So anyway, George Mason included that line in the Virginia Bill of Rights in the 17 before the Constitutional Convention, and whenever that was, because I know Madison, this was one of his very first cutting his teeth at the state legislature. He was a junior legislator, and he got into that committee working with George Mason, and that line was injected into that. And I don't think so. Most people never knew where that came from. And you have to really, you know, be, I don't want to say scholarly, but you have to be really literate to go through enough material to find out when was that first uttered. And that was technically first uttered in 1770, because that's the first instance where those words were formed. So anyway, the point is that Patrick Henry, he made his comment, you know, that wrote his name into history, give me liberty or give me death. And he wasn't there other than to basically protect the cabal, but he wasn't there to, you know, protect for something of a self-interest. And anybody that is a Mason relative, then they probably feel like I'm, you know, just being harsh on the Mason name. I'm only making a point that this is the kind of characters sometimes you deal with, where people have, I'll just call it creative, you know, this creative license or this creative, you know, focus that, hey, I want my name, like Mark Levin, trying to, you know, get an amendment so that he goes down in the history as, that's my amendment, regardless of how crappy it was. Anyway, so let's go ahead and read this little snippet from Patrick Henry.
So you're talking about every man de-armed?
Yep, that, right there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. May we not discipline and arm them, as well as Congress, if the power be concurrent, so that our militia shall have two sets of arms, double sets of regimentals, etc., and thus, at a very great cost, we shall be doubted doubly armed. The great object is that every man be armed, but can the people afford to pay for double sets of arms? Everyone who is able may have a gun, but we have learned by experience that necessary as it is to have arms, and though our assembly has, by a succession of laws for many years, endeavored to have the militia completely armed, it is still far from being the case. When this power is given up to Congress, without limitation or bounds, how will your militia be afraid? You trust to chance. For sure I am that nation which shall trust its liberties in others' hands cannot long exist. If gentlemen are serious when they suppose a concurrent power, where can be the impolicy to amend it? Or in other words, to say that Congress shall not arm or discipline them till the states shall have refused or neglected to do it? This is my object. I only wish to bring it to what they themselves say is implied. Implication is to be the foundation of our civil liberties, and when you speak of arming the militia by a concurrence of power, you use implication. The implication will not save you when a strong army of veterans comes upon you. You would be laughed at by the whole world for trusting your safety implicitly to implication.
Okay, so they know also, because I've said this before, they're very well aware of the fact that the federal government's going to come along and give them, basically an apportionment tax, that they're going to come along and say, you have to pay this tax. Well, basically, if the militia is not being armed, if they don't see the money being poured into creating the initial investment, and then, because once you put the money out there, one of the things, you know, you realize is there's always an initial estimate, an initial cost. Okay, so everybody's going to be cooked, so we got to get everybody, you know, pots and pans, we got to get everybody knives and the things, the tools you need to be a cook, or infantrymen, the tools you need to be an infantryman. So that's what they need to do. And what he's saying here is that they can get out of it. And I have said that the Constitution says Congress shall have the power to, right here, provide for arming. In other words, they are to provide for it. And so the arming and disciplining. If the states are being given a requisition, then what they all they have to do is basically say, we're not going to pay this, and we're going to take that money, and we're going to basically use that to arm our militia, because you have a responsibility to do that. We'd be happy to pay more in taxes for what you're doing, but bottom line, you're failing to do your job. And so the states should be able to push back, and it's kind of like if somebody has an obligation and they fail to fulfill that obligation, then instead of paying them for what you need to do, because there is something, like I said, they're taxing them, they need this money for doing these things, but they should have also been paying to do this. Now, just remember, out the gate, Hamilton went down the path of assuming the debt. We covered that last year. We're going to cover it again when we're done here, when we're done with the ratification debates, when we move forward in the new formed government. And so we'll show how Hamilton basically assumed all this debt, and what did he do with it? So that he could create, so one of the things, they didn't go out and pay off all the debt. He just assumed it. But he still had the responsibility as the Secretary of Treasury to ensure within the budget that money was being allocated to get it out to the states so that they could have what the standards of armaments were, you know, to have these guns and to have this and that for the militia. They all ignored it. Do you see my point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the states should have said, hey, you're ignoring this. That's their job. And this is kind of what Patrick Henry is alluding to, but he's actually making it into this derogatory, because the states actually could levy a counter, in other words, to say, because we pay this, we're not paying that tax. There has to be a reconciliation. And so bottom line, when Congress does a budget and they're doing legitimate financing, they actually have to be spending the money on those things that are important. Now, here's the problem. If Congress is focusing on these other things instead of focusing on what the states think are important, then you have a conflict. So this only goes to show that the states equally neglected the militia as well. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so whose fault was it? It was both of their faults, but I think it was a leadership problem, because leaders do the right thing. And so they should have recognized that we have a strategic need to do this. And instead of creating the bureaucracy of what they were trying to do with the Department of War, they should have actually started at the ground level in making sure that the structure of the militia was being prepared and being, I'll just say, procured, so that moving forward, this nation would have a, you know, an incredible defense system. Anyway. Okay, so let's move down to Mr. Nicholas. Now, Mr. Nicholas kind of responds to Patrick Henry after he finishes his oration, kind of a short one, but anyway, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the great object of government in every country is security and public defense. I suppose, therefore, that what we ought to attend to here is what is the best mode of enabling the general government to protect us. One of three ways must be pursued for this purpose. We must either empower them to employ and rely altogether on a standing army or depend altogether on militia, or else we must enable them to use the one or the other of these two ways as may be found most expedient. The least reflection will satisfy us that the convention has adopted the only proper method. If a standing army were to alone to be employed, such as an army must be kept up in time of peace as would be sufficient in war. The dangers of such an army are so striking that every man would oppose the adoption of this government had it been proposed by it as the only mode of defense. Would it be safe to depend on militia alone without the agency of regular forces even in time of war? Were we to be invaded by a powerful, disciplined army, should we be safe with militia? Could men unacquainted with the hardships and unskilled in the discipline of war, men only inured to the peaceable occupations of domestic life, encounter with success the most skillful veterans inured to the fatigues and toils of campaigns? Although some people are pleased with the theory of reliance on militia as the sole defense of a nation, yet I think it will be found in practice to be by no means adequate. Its inadequacy is proved by the experience of other nations. But were it fully adequate, it would be unequal. If war be supported by militia, it is by personal service. The poor man does as much as the rich. Is this just? What is the consequence when war is carried on by regular troops? They are paid by taxes raised from the people according to their property, and then the rich man pays an adequate share.
Okay, so...
Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, no. So at this point, I think he's losing, because I think everybody failed because they didn't recognize that there's this thing called the Navy out there, too. They have a standing Navy, mm-hmm. which has a Marine Corps. And so there's no reason why they wouldn't be able to bolster that, because when you actually guard yourself from external threats, remember, they marginalized the Navy. We got, our D.C. was burnt down in 1812 because they marginalized the Navy and a good coastal defense and a good coastal, warning system and all of that. So, bottom line, instead of having the Navy that they needed, they basically just said, okay, we're going to create this system that will lend towards more of something that we don't have the authority to do, that would actually create a standing army. To do that, they would need to amend the Constitution. Because if they're going to actually employ people separately from calling forth the militia, that's not... Remember, the Constitution has been constantly justified by the objects that are enumerated in it. If it's not enumerated, they can't do it. It's that simple.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's talking about this, and he's right. As far as the militia goes, everybody pays equal. But when we do have mercenary forces, and this is a good conflict, or I should say a good compare and contrast, between using a militia in your county level instead of having a hired mercenary force to basically disarm you and to supposedly provide you with protection. They've been on this for a long time, and look at today, where the progressives have basically made everybody vulnerable. They don't care about protecting your property anymore, and they don't want you to do it either. They want to they want to scare everybody, and they want everybody to basically surrender to the totalitarian state. That's their end goal. This is one of the reasons why many people left California, because when in the early 2000s, when California stopped protecting people's property, when they literally started turning their back and actually focused on helping the illegals get settled and giving them assistance and providing more and more housing and so forth, that was the warning sign. And my wife and I, that's why we left. If you're not going to protect our property and our lives, then we will go somewhere where we can do it and or have, you know, other people with us protect ourselves. So anyway, go ahead. Keep going.
Right. Cool. But if you confine yourself to militia alone, the poor man is oppressed. The rich man exempts himself by furnishing a substitute. And although it be oppressive to the poor, it is not advantageous. Is it not advantageous to the rich? For what he gives would pay regular troops. It is therefore neither safe nor just to depend entirely on militia.
Okay, so one of the things, let me jump in here. One of the things that most people don't know is if you choose not to go, you have to pay for the person that replaces you. You have to pay their wages. So that's what he's talking about. That if the rich don't go, then they just have to, you know, throw out what the government's paying. And you know, in the economy of cost, right, when you get, create a big army, it may be a big price, but the marginal cost goes down. So the cost of every person in the army goes down dramatically. Cheaper by the dozen kind of thing. And so anyway, I just want everybody to know that it was the law back then that you didn't have to fight. You could actually, but you had to deploy. You had to find somebody that would take your place and pay them.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Okay, keep going.
All right. As these two ways are ineligible, let us consider the third method. Does this Constitution put this on a proper footing? It enables Congress to raise an army when necessary or to call forth the militia when necessary. What will be the consequence of their having these two powers? To there be a necessity for an army to be raised, militia will do. And when an army will be raised, the militia will still be employed, which will render a less numerous army sufficient. By these means, there will be a sufficient defense for the country without having a standing army altogether or oppressing the people. The worthy member has said that it ought to be part of the Constitution that the militia ought not to go out of the state without the consent of the state legislature. What would be the consequence of this? The general defense is trusted to the general government. How is it to protect the Union? It must apply to the state governments before it can do it. Is this right? Is it not subjecting the general will to the particular will and exposing the general defense to the particular caprice of the members of the state governments? This would entirely defeat the power given to Congress to provide for the general defense, and unless the militia were to aid in the execution of the laws when resisted, the other powers of Congress would be nugatory. But he has said that this idea is justified by the English history, for that the king has the power of the sword, but must apply to the commons for the means of using it, for the purse. This is not a similar case. The king and commons are parts of the same government, but the general government is separate and perfectly distinct from the individual government of the states. Should Congress be obliged to apply to the particular states for the militia, they may be refused and the government overturned. To make the case similar, he ought to show us that the king and parliament were obliged to call on some other power to raise forces and provide for the means of carrying on war, for otherwise there is no similitude.
Okay, so he's pointing out... The Article 1, Section 8 has Congress to call forth the militia. And so that is the essence of forming and actually raising an army. In other words, putting out the requisitions that we need to have an army to go and defend ourselves on the southern border for this purpose. I've said this before. The only reasons why the federal government needs to do anything internal of the United States. Internal is executing the laws, suppressing insurrections, or repelling invasions. How is an army going to be required if it's not an insurrection? It's not. I mean, so in other words, the militia is the army. There's no mechanism because they have a navy. And I think that there was this I'll call it the evolution of this concept of I want to have an army. I want the army and I want to have this control. Because bottom line, government has this this insidious, I'll just say this insidious nature to create excessiveness. In other words, duplicating. And so when we look at the armed forces, why do we actually have an army, air force? Because what we have are two separate strategic interests, external threats and internal threats. External threats would be invasions. So who should be dealing with invasions that are coming from the sea? The Navy. If it's coming from Mexico, then it would be the militia. Insurrections, that would be, you know, the militia. How is it that there would be a need for, because I don't want to say these men didn't understand, but they made it way too complex. The United States definitely has two separate interests of security, internal security and external. The Navy, and the purpose of creating the Navy was to ensure from, you know, to protect us and ensure that we can't be harmed from external threats. Now, the on land access, the Navy doesn't necessarily do that. But technically, if you gave the Navy the strategic role of doing that, then why couldn't you actually deploy, instead of it being, you call it an army, but what is the Marine Corps? The Marine Corps is not the sailors. They actually have the ability to, you know, wage war on, you know, on the beachfronts and, you know, on land. I mean, they are a land fighting force. So if the Navy's role was to actually create this, then the Navy would be, let me say it this way, they'd be the big dog. And that's what, there would only be one big dog. How many special forces or elite organizations exist within the United States? Well, I would say the Marines, and then you have the SEALs, then you have Delta and so forth, right? And most people say, you know, the Marines, you know, you can't say that because it's been said many times that the Marines are the elite fighting force. I mean, you know, I think it was said that let somebody know that the Marines are coming, that just puts the fear of God in them. But nevertheless, we're talking about elite fighting forces, so there's recon in the Marine Corps, there's the SEALs, there's Delta, and so forth. And these are special fighting forces. Well, why does every branch have that? Because it's a lot of money. It's a lot of training. There's to be elite. Well, why would we need to have SEALs being deployed in the United States? Think about that, folks, as we go on to a breakdown. Think about, why would we need to have strategic forces that would never deploy outside the United States? If you look at the two distinctive strategies, protecting the homeland and then external protection, there really is only two forces. Why would we duplicate this? And it's only for money and politics. I'm Jim Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.